Okay, so that's actually the file I was working on my computer that you're seeing. It's the machine on my desk. So if the network goes down, we get to go home faster today. For whatever reason, the latest version somehow did not get registered onto my directory. So I'll put it up. Steve Campbell and Garrett Wolf. Garrett Wolf? There is no Garrett Wolf? Wow. Okay. Questions? Any questions? So on next Monday is the midterm. And so we returned the homework to, and I also put in the homework to solutions, and along with the solution for homework to, I also put in an entire midterm, so you get an idea what is the length, etc. So it probably it's likely to be in that sort of a format. Any questions on anything else? Okay. So what I plan to do today is actually filtering and recommender systems, which is what I said I'll do, and we were about to get into it last week. But before I do that, I just wanted to mention one thing which I sort of went through, I mean, I forgot to mention last time. We were talking about feature selection and the connection between feature selection and latent semantic indexing last time, right? And this point I made, which is the specific feature selection technique that we used, which is the mutual information-based feature selection. We were trying to contrast it to the way LSI would work. And one important obvious connection we made is, LSI would have found linear combinations of features in the new feature space, okay? Whereas MI, the mutual information-based approach, was just picking each feature in itself, by itself, and deciding whether to keep it, whether it's correlated or not. Okay, so that's one interesting point. In fact, while talking about that, you notice that mutual information idea can be easily defeated, okay, the way it was being used, because what we were doing was we were comparing the correlation between an individual feature and the class label. Sometimes individual labels might be uncorrelated or not well correlated with the class label, but combinations of them will be well correlated with the class label. For example, suppose the class label is an XR of the individual features. So there are like 10,000 features, and feature 1 and feature 4, the XR of those is very well correlated with class label. Okay, then neither feature 1 by itself nor feature 4 by itself would have high enough correlation with the class to actually even come into the selected features list. Okay, so you can always handle this. What would you do? I mean, how could you handle this kind of an issue? One brute force way would be to not only consider individual features but also consider sets of features. Okay, and the reason we don't do it is because there are exponential number, 2n subsets of features. So even if you just consider two features at a time, it's n squared. Okay? So that's one thing to realize. And in fact, we just, it has this problem, but we use it anyway in the text classification. That's what we did. Okay. But then, you know, compared to LSI, MI is actually picking either single features or at best sets of features. Not combinations, not linear combinations, for example, while LSI was doing that. That's an interesting difference. A more interesting difference, so presumably you could have, if you wanted, done LSI on the data and taken the top K directions as the features and done class, you know, basically use them further. Okay, but in saying so, we're sort of missing another important point, which is the way LSI is done it does not care about classes. It doesn't actually, you know, latent semantic indexing, which is basically also principal components analysis, does not care about class labels. It assumes no class labels are available. So all it's trying to do is it's trying to maximize the variance. So it's trying to find the direction in which the variance is maximum. So consider this example. Okay, here is a bunch of data points in two dimensions. Okay, each point is a data point. Now, I would argue that if you are doing LSI, this is likely to be the principal direction you will find. Because if you were to take the projection of all the data along that axis, it has the highest variance. So now the data nicely spreads out. And not surprisingly, if you were to do it, if you were to actually do LSI on this, you would a PCI on this, this would be the principal component. Okay. However, suppose I actually told you that this is one class right here, and this is another class right there. Okay. Now what would be the best direction to project the data in? So it's no longer that I don't know anything about the data, they're just a bunch of data points. I know that this happens to be one class, and this happens to be another class. And presumably, the moment I said that, my expectation is that when I get a new point, then I need to decide whether it's class one or class two, which is the kind of thing we do in supervised learning, in the classification task. So now, if I were to tell you that these are two different classes, would this still be the best single feature, single direction to project the data in? No. In fact, it's ugly. It's not at all a good direction. Because in this direction, if you project the data into this direction, class one and class two will get jumbled up. So what would be the best direction to project it in? It's sort of like that. Okay? Again, I'm still talking about geometry. You know, what would be the best single line to project this data in? It'll be like this, because that way the two classes would be separated the most. So in fact, when you're trying to do dimensionality reduction, when you know the class labels, what you really should be doing is this. Okay? And this is actually called linear discriminant analysis. In fact, Fisher linear discriminant analysis. Okay, and what Fisher linear discriminant analysis is doing is just like LSI is trying to maximize the variance in the direction, it's trying to project the data into the first direction across which its variance is maximum. And then it will project into the second direction, which is perpendicular to the first direction, in which the data is again, the variance is again maximum. That's what LSI is doing. That doesn't make sense once I know classes. Once I know classes, what I'm interested in doing is two things at the same time. I want to make sure that the distance, I want to project these points into a direction such that in the projection, the distances between points belonging to the same class are minimized, and the distances between points belonging to the different classes are maximized. When did you hear this last? Clustering, if you know the clusters. So you really want to find the best direction where you can see the clusters in the two clusters that I already told you in this data. Okay? And it's again a different constrained maximization problem. So you actually minimize this maximization together. Okay? And that is actually called LDA, linear discriminant analysis. The unfortunate thing is LDA is not as nicely related to eigenvalues and eigenvectors the way PCA is. So the question then is PCA or the LSI, is LSI a special case or general case of LDA? If you must compare them, what would you say? Is LDA the special case or general case of LSI, or vice versa? I would say that LSI is really a special case of LDA, because you're doing less amount of maximization. You're only caring about variance. That's it. Now, how could you do that then? What happened to the class? Well, each data point is its own class. If you think of each data point to be its own class, okay, then in essence, what you're doing would be just maximizing the distance between classes. Because within class distance is already zero, you can't do anything different. Okay, so that's a nice connection to understand. Nobody actually does, not too many people do LSI or LDA in the as the pre-processing step for classification. Most of the time you do something more like the mutual information MI, which is much simpler. And yet it's worth knowing because it's connected to the notion of LSI that you know before. And you know, you almost sort of did half the sentence. I said, well, LSI and MI are connected. One is taking linear combinations, other is taking individual features. But the difference is actually a little more deeper than that. In the case of LSI, the original LSI idea doesn't even understand classes. It assumes, in essence, that there are no classes or that everybody is its own class. The moment you have classes, then your maximization problem becomes minimization-maximization problem. Minimizing the distance inside the class and maximizing the distance of the class, okay? And in fact, LDA, linear discriminant analysis, is actually a pretty darn good method for classification. Okay? In fact, I think it's good enough that I think last year, Jiping Ye, one of our new machine learning faculty members, got a best paper award, best outstanding student paper award. At that time, he was still a student, for in essence finding a better, more efficient version of LDA. Okay? And what happened? Okay. And so, in fact, people do use LDA in general in classification, not as much in text classification. Okay. That's about that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about personalization recommendations. I think I sort of talked about these things already. And then this also has been talked about. And that also has been talked about. This I didn't say anything last time. The feedback, in essence, we are talking about filtering and recommendation, where user did something with a website or something, and then trying to use that user's actions to figure out what the user might be interested in later and then give more of that, or more recommendations, or prefetching, et cetera, et cetera. So one interesting question is, how do you even how do you even gain the feedback from the user? And obviously, there are intrusive methods where you can ask the user, tell me, do you like this, do you like this, do you like this? Okay, which normally don't scale well because, you know, when was the last time you actually took one of those surveys that every website these days asks you? If you go to New York Times and you try to read an article, they'll say, here's a small, quick 3-millisecond survey, would you like to take it? Unless I've been, you know, I'm totally different from you guys, I never take those. And I'll spend 4 minutes get rid of that window rather than actually take the survey. Okay. So nobody actually gives intrusive feedback, I mean, direct feedback. Okay. And so what you need to do is get non-intrusive feedback. So based on the things that people have bought already, based on the things that people are staring at, on the pages people are staring at, et cetera, you need to get feedback from that. And a great paper on some of the issues involved in using indirect feedback, at least in search kind of scenarios, is the one that I talked about several weeks back in the class, and I mentioned the paper too, where they essentially had, you know, they were actually computing the how much time people are spending looking at the first answer versus second answer. And thankfully, it was non-intrusive. I mean, it looks like a classic intrusive thing where you have to put a couple of electrodes on your brain, but apparently, there's enough technology out there now that, you know, it's just a little camera on top of your machine, which is capturing how much time you're spending on which parts of the screen. Okay, so these kinds of things are now available. However, it's also interesting that, remember, they talked about all sorts of pitfalls in interpreting the user feedback. For example, the user feedback might sometimes be biased by what you're trying to measure. That was a classic case in that search engine thing where you know, they were just looking at the first answer, irrespective of whether the first answer was the real first answer or whether it's the second answer which was being put in the first answer place, because they believed Google cannot be wrong. Okay. Anyway, so there is this interesting issue of how do you get the feedback. Some of the things that we'll be talking about, in for example, in you know, the where book recommendations are done in Amazon and so on, basically what they're doing, what are they doing? What sorts of things does Amazon do to give you recommendations? What is the feedback it's taking? How many people haven't ever actually looked at Amazon site? So I'm not making any assumptions. Everybody knows. I mean, maybe you had enough money to buy a book or not, but at least you will have looked at it. So the question is, what are the kinds of feedback that Amazon is capturing from you? What? Yeah, so it's not just the buying ones. The ones that you bought, definitely. But in fact, any time you click on a page, it remembers. And in fact, it remembers so much so that it's in your face. You know, it's like next time you'll say, this is the page you made. So these are all the things that you looked at. So they're capturing all that information. Okay, so that's also part of the feedback. Now, of course, if you see a thing versus if you buy the thing, in essence, you're rating it in different ways. You know, see it, yeah, it's good enough to see, but not to buy. Buy, you know, I put the money and then got a copy of it. So that should mean much higher rating, presumably. Okay, and what are all the places where Amazon uses, what are all the kinds of things, places where Amazon uses this data that it collects from you? It recommends it to you. It says, we have recommendations for you, and you click on it, it will tell you what are all the recommendations. What else? That's a new thing they started. In fact, it's been like a couple of months, I mean, maybe 3-4 months since. So if you look at a particular item, it will tell you that 66% of the people who actually viewed this page, viewed this item, eventually bought this item. 33% bought this other item. And many a time it's extremely useful information, because in fact oftentimes it's opposite too. I mean, I would be trying to look at some particular item and they'll say 33% of the people who looked at this eventually bought this and bought something, eventually bought this, and 66% did something else. So then I want to see that. You know, why should I be the only guy who buys this costly stuff? Okay, again, useful information that basically you'll find useful in your buying. Okay. So those are the things that that Amazon uses. Amazon is a great case in point, because they use this filtering a lot. Content and by the way, how many of you know that Amazon is starting in Phoenix? There is a So Amazon is starting in Phoenix. So you know, I'm sure you can go and tell them that you can do this for them. I think it's a-z.com or a-z.phoenix or some such thing. But they opened already. And you know, they don't have anybody yet, but they're starting here too. I just hope that that's not going to be one of these book warehouses where if you join, all you get to do is take the book, put it in a package, and put it in the UPS truck. Something hopefully more interesting than that. But anyway, so you have two types of things. One is content-based filtering, and other is collaborative filtering. And content-based essentially is text classification. It's just a classification, not text classification, but classification. So for all the things that you may have bought, they have feature vector representation of all these things. Let's say if there are books, then there are feature vector representation of these books. And then the class is, yes, he bought it, no, he didn't buy it. I looked at it, but didn't buy it. And so you can use that to figure out what is the rating for that particular, what are you likely to do for that particular new book, a particular new book. By the way, the classes don't have to be, yes, no kind of classes. It could be a rating. So each book is sent to rating 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. up to 10. 10 is the highest, okay, 9 is lowest. So there are 10 classes now. Okay, so you can do naive-based classification with 10 classes just as well as you can do it with 2 classes. Okay? So then the other one that we'll spend a little bit more time before you go back to combining this and that is a collaborative filtering. And the idea there is there are a bunch of users who have, so each user has given a rating to each of the items, A to Z in this case. So this is the ratings matrix for each user. So if you have an item rating matrix, you know, you can use this data to make the item rating matrix. So the obvious thing that we do is you are trying to use, so suppose you have a new user who came. I mean, this is the guy who you're trying to give recommendations to, and this guy currently has some ratings. Hopefully he has bought some, I mean, rated some of the items, okay? And so what you're doing is you are comparing this rating vector to these rating vectors to look for the rating vector that is closest to this one. And once you figure that out, you know, it could be the top one or top k rating vectors that are closest to it. And once you compute the best ones, let's say in this particular case, let's say those two are, and it's reasonable in this case said 9, 3, and 5, that says actually 9, 3, and 5, this says 10, 4, and 1. Okay? And so if you think those are the best two, then what you're trying to do is you're going to use, these are your nearest neighbors in terms of ratings, and from them, you're going to give extra recommendations to this guy. So you don't tell this guy, look, are you stupid or something? This other guy, the rating for Z, according to this guy, is 1, so you should change your 5 to a 1. That's not what we are in it for. We could, but that's not what we are in it for. If we are trying to sell this guy, what we want to do is, this guy is already about to buy this. You know, he's at least 50% likely. So we want to get him to buy more things. And so in this case, what we're doing is, well, this guy hasn't even seen C, so didn't rate it. And this guy has seen C and given it an 8. Okay, and so you can tell this guy, look, look, you might be interested in C. That's how it's collaborative filtering. So what are the technical things that we need to deal with here? Question, of course, is how do I compare this vector to this vector? In essence, how do I find my k nearest neighbors? And furthermore, in essence, actually, if I can figure out my similarity to other user ratings, my vector similarity to other user vector ratings, then that similarity itself can be seen as the, and you know, you can, top k would be the top k similarities. Okay, so the real issue is, how do you compute those similarities? Okay. And as I said, this is really, you know, to, at some level, actually, you know, this is sort of like doing correlation clustering. Okay. I will give you a slightly different method because it has some advantages, but it's, you know, fairly similar to the correlation cluster method that you've seen previously. So what we're going to do is compute the similarity weighting between two vectors, a similarity metric between two vectors, okay? And the similarity metric itself becomes, in essence, if you take top k similarities and the vectors corresponding to top k similarities, that would be your top k neighbors, okay? So all you're going to do, in essence, is the following. So if you have, this is a fairly standard thing, a Pearson correlation coefficient, and what you're doing is if you have an active user A and another user U, okay, you're just taking the similarity is really taken as covariance of RA and RU divided by the variance of RA and variance of RU. Okay, in fact, standard deviation of RA and standard deviation of RU. Okay, now the advantage of this is if RA is equal to RU, then what would this number be? That means if I'm doing, so this RA is the ratings vector. RU is another ratings vector. If the two vectors are the same, then in essence, the covariance would be the same as variance. Variance is square of the standard deviation. So essentially, this number would be 1 when it's the same vector. It's exactly the same vector. And it will be between 0 and 1 otherwise. Minus 1 and 1. Okay, the idea is if you are perfectly uncorrelated, whenever you give very high value, the other guy is giving very low value. That's useful information too. Okay? But it is one when you have the same vector. Okay. Now, here is just the definitions of covariance. Covariance is essentially you take all the ratings and you first normalize them with respect to the mean. So you make them zero mean. The way you make them zero mean is you compute the mean of the ratings and subtract it. What's the advantage of that? The advantage of it is some people are easy to please. Okay, so if you have ratings from 1 to 10, some people will start at 6. Pretty much everything is about a 6. And then the really good ones are like 9. And some people are hard to please. They'll say, pretty much everything in the world sucks, so it's 1. And the ones I buy suck a little less, so that's like a 3. Okay? So you want to keep these numbers in some reasonable normalized fashion. So if you actually subtract the mean, you're doing it partly, not fully, you're doing it partly. Okay, how far is your thing from mean? And in fact, the normal way to do it is how many sigmas is your this rating from your mean rating? And that sigma is actually the variance of your rating. That's why when you get grades, they talk about this normal distribution and they say, here is the mean, and if you are 1 sigma away, 2 sigmas away, et cetera, et cetera. You heard the word Six Sigma kid, right? So you know what that means. Okay. Anyway, so that's your covariance, and these are your variance definitions. Variance you should know. And covariance essentially is taking the multiplication for each item, the RA minus, so for each item, how far is the A's rating of that item from its mean rating multiplied by how far is U's rating from its mean. And you can see why this can be negative, right? Some item could have negative from your mean. Okay? So that's your covariance, that's your that's your Pearson correlation coefficient. Okay. Once you have that, all you need to do is given a neighbor, select the correlated users as the top k correlated users as your neighbors from whom you are going to extract information. Okay? And in fact, the specific thing that we would do is something like this. Suppose I have, given a new item, for every item, basically, I would compute the score, the expected score, expected rating of the current user for that item to be the mean of this guy's scores plus this delta, where the delta is essentially a weighted summation of how all your neighbors are giving ratings for this guy. Okay, so for each of your neighbors, you take that neighbor's rating, how far that neighbor's rating for this item is from his or her mean, multiply it by the weight. The weight is essentially the Pearson correlation coefficient. Okay, so people who are much similar to you in overall set of ratings, if they are actually liking this particular item more, then that means much more than a guy who is not at all similar to you, or who is completely uncorrelated with you, who happens to like this item. That shouldn't mean much. Okay. Now, one thing that I should mention, by the way, is this is very important. The RA and RU are not just the entire rating vectors. It's only the rating vectors. Basically, you're going to do these computations only over the set of items that both A and U have rated. You can't just assume that if you didn't write anything, I'll give it a number. Okay. Normally, the percentage of if you were to write a ratings matrix, do you know what is the number of how sparse it's likely to be or how dense it's likely to be? In fact, there are numbers out there, but it's basically like low digit percentage, 3-4% full matrix. Okay. How many books have you rated in Amazon? Okay. So that gives you an idea. And you're still doing collaborative filtering. Okay. Even though you haven't looked at the entire list of Amazon's books and rated all of them, they're still doing collaborative filtering. So one important thing to realize actually is that the ratings matrix is highly sparse. And these these notions of similarity better be done only in terms of the items that you share, that you as well as the other guy have rated together. Okay, now there is, so basically, so this is pretty fairly simple, it's not that hard. Okay, this is essentially your new rating. You know, the rating for all the items, for every item, this is supposed to be the rating that you should have given it if you went with what your neighbors are saying. And if this item is something that you have seen, you ignore the prediction. If it's an item that you haven't yet rated, the system can tell you, you know, you might want to look at it because its rating is high enough. Its rating for you is high enough. And this is user-specific rating, right? Because it's user-specific because the similarities are user-specific. Okay. Now the only thing that differentiates here is this example that I once made up, and which is this issue of how do you take care of the following situation. So you're married to somebody for about 25 years, been seeing movies, okay, and you know, marriage isn't going well, but there is this new recent movie that has come out, and your spouse gave it a pretty low rating, okay, but you're also carrying on with somebody in the office for the last 3 weeks, okay, and this person gave this movie a very high rating. So the question is, which one do you take? I mean, should you be considering this movie to be highly similar to your taste or not very highly similar to your taste? Okay. So the question that I'm making here is, should history matter? Should the fact that you and your spouse probably have many more items that you rated together versus this other person who probably with whom you have only rated 5 items together? And especially in the first 3 weeks, you know, the whole way of keeping this going is to keep agreeing, you know, happily. Okay. So how does collaborative filtering deal with this and you know, keep the family values in good shape? And the basic thing is, this is one little thing that's missing here, which is this rating does not take into account over how many shared items was this covariance computed. So throw that in. Okay. So you put a thing called significance weighting. Significance weighting is basically based on the number of items you have actually rated together. The higher the number of items you rated together, the more it is. And Pearson correlation coefficient is not connected to the number of items. It's only connected to, of those that you rated together, how do your ratings correlate? You need both. Okay? So what do? You basically do this times that. Okay? And for this, normally what seems to work quite well is to say that for some number, let's say 50, you know, where some threshold, if you have done more than these many items, you know, if the user and the current user have done more than these many items together, if they have rated more than these many items, okay, then they're basically considered highly significant, one. If not, their significance is linearly dependent on, you know, the number of items divided by 50. That's it. This idea works quite well. In general, it seems to make the distinction that, you know, I mean, there is some user with whom you have perfect correlation with the 2 items that you share, whereas this other user with whom you have much lower correlation with the 10,000 items that you have shared together. And what you really should do is you have to take into account the significance. And that's what this is doing. Okay? So that's called collaborative filtering. There are other small variations on this, but this is pretty reasonable understanding of what happens in most collaborative filtering systems. Okay? Now, there are all sorts of problems with collaborative filtering. Cold start, there needs to be enough other users in the system before you could actually use the users to. I mean, if you don't have Joneses, you can't keep up with them. So that's basically what this guy is saying. Sparsity, if there are many items to be recommended, even if there are many users, the user ratings metric is extremely sparse. In fact, this is true right now. The user ratings matrix for Amazon is probably like 3 or 4% full. That's it. Okay. And then the first rater cannot recommend an item that has not yet been previously rated. Yeah, of course. Okay, but this is an issue. Okay, the book just came into the market, and and you have bought every possible statistics and computer science book in your life, and this is like the best statistics and computer science book, but nobody has yet bought it. Collaborative filtering won't allow Amazon to recommend it to you. So it's useful. Okay. Now you'll notice that all the problems of collaborative filtering, as you're looking at this, some of them at least are not problems for content-based filtering. In fact, the way I told you, the frustrator, you have bought statistics books before, so you know Amazon can still tell you buy this book because you have bought them. Okay. Now the popularity bias. This is another interesting thing, which is popular items become important just because they're popular. Okay. This is the issue of what do you mean you don't care about some particular latest and greatest popular item? You must be interested because everybody else is interested. That sort of thing. So these are the issues for collaborative filtering. And then there is the other issue, which is the content-based filtering. And we pretty much understand this. Essentially, each item is described as a vector of features. And the rating is its class label. You're given some training data, which is for a bunch of items, you're given the description as well as the ratings. You, the computer program. And then you're trying to learn the user's model for assigning ratings. And given a new item, you want to predict its rating based on what the user has done in the past. That's content-based filtering. And we did talk about a bunch of things, such as nearest neighbors and also the most useful one, which is naive-based classifier and its variations to do that. Okay. Now, content-based filtering has advantages. No need on data from other users. But that could be also a negative problem. That means you're not actually using other users. It's able to recommend to users with unique tastes, and it's able to recommend new and unpopular items, and can provide explanations of recommended items by listing content. Okay, this is the other interesting thing. Does Amazon give you explanations as to why they're recommending books to you? It does, by the way. You're not buying enough books. You're buying chocolates, not candies, not instead of books. Amazon actually does provide. So if you go to your My page, your name, and say there's a page for you, and you go to the page and it'll tell you all these recommendations, and they sometimes will say explain it at the next level. And so if you click on it, it'll tell you why it thinks you would be interested in it. And oftentimes, if the recommendation was based on collaborative filtering, all they can say is, look, people buy it, okay, you should buy it. That's the only explanation. That's it. So you intimidate them. Whereas if it is based on content-based filtering, they can actually say, look, you bought Knuth's book on algorithms, this other guy's book on kernel machines, and this other guy's book on, the greatest AI machine or whatever. Based on all this, I have decided this book should be bought for you because it has the following common keywords. They give this. It's not hard. They're doing it all the time. So content-based filtering, you can explain. Collaborative filtering, you can't explain. It's like Joneses have it, so you should have it. That's all. Okay. So that's the interesting point to have. And then, as I said, this is a well-known technology. Content-based filtering is based on classification learning, and there's a whole field or fields, which work on classification learning. Looks like it's all good for content-based filtering. The bad thing, of course, is the following. Requires content that can be encoded as meaningful features. This was, again, the issue of who converts items into features. What's the right features for items? Okay. And user's taste must be represented as a learnable function of these content, these features. And if you pick the wrong features, they may not be connected to user's classification. And so you would wind up doing badly in terms of learning. Okay. And of course, it's unable to exploit anything about other users' judgment. And one of the nicest things is, as far as collaborative filtering is concerned, It could say, since you bought these books, you just bought a book. At that point, it can say, buy this car. Because everybody who bought this book bought this car. So as far as it's concerned, books, cars, everything, you know, is the stuff to just get rid of and sell it to the user. What's interesting is, items don't have to be represented as features. If you represent a car in terms of its features, that vector is basically incomparable to a book represented in terms of its features. So content-based filtering mechanism, which is meant for book recommendation, is not likely to do well at all in your car test. Collaborative filtering crosses these. You know, everybody who is buying this book is also buying this car. Just go buy it. And you know, to the extent we are not particular, there is correlations between the way people work in the world, it might be a good thing. Okay? So this is just a long argument to say that both shall be used. Neither of them are good enough by themselves, and you should use both of them. And it's good because I have a slide to explain how to use both of them. Here's the idea. So, there are many, many ways you can use them both. Okay, one of course is compute the rating based on the content-based filtering, compute the rating for this new item based on the collaborative filtering, do an alpha times the first plus beta times the second, and learn alpha and beta over people that you have. You can always do that. You can always combine apples and oranges and life will be good. Okay? But if you don't want to do that, you can do different approach, which is use one to feed into the other. In fact, these are the two things we did for PageRank, in the authorities hub sorts of idea. PageRank and similarity, text-based similarity ideas. In one, you do alpha times page similarity, text-based similarity plus beta times PageRank. In the other, you essentially use the similarity to get the base set, expand it, and then use the link information to pick the best among them. Okay, and so I'm going to use basically the equivalent of the second idea now. Okay, so what I'll do in this case is I will use the content-based filtering. So the problem with collaborative filtering is oftentimes there are not enough significant users in terms of users who have enough common ratings with your ratings. It's bad enough that you have only rated 2% of the items in Amazon, but it's also unfortunate that these other guys also rated 2% of the items in Amazon, and then it's very likely that the intersection between your 2% and their 2% is negligibly small. And so significance weights are likely to be quite low. So you can improve significance weights if you have more common ratings. So what I could then do is the following, very simple idea, which is, suppose this was my user ratings vector for all the items, what are my ratings? Now, of course, only the parts that have this blue, brighter blue in it, those are the items that I have actually rated. So what I can do is I can use those as a training example, learn an NBC classifier about what constitutes my ratings. For now, just assume these are all books. For now, okay? Let's say books are just pages or something, items of the same kind. Okay? And having learned the classifier, use the classifier to predict what would have been this user's ratings on the rest of the items. That's what a learner is supposed to do, right? So you take the training examples, learn the classifier, apply it to unseen example, the rest of the items, which are currently unlabeled. They're there, but they're unlabeled. That's because I never bothered to open them. And so it just quickly went and behind my back said, these are all the ratings that you would have put if you actually looked at it. So now I have a pseudo ratings vector, which has some real numbers, which are actual ratings that the user gave, and some made-up numbers, which are ratings that I filled in, interpolated by classifying, by learning a classifier based on the original number. So now once I have a pseudo rating vector which is full, I can apply collaborative filtering on top of that. Do you see what I'm saying? So now all the rating vectors are 100% full. And so you could get pretty darn high significance ratings. In fact, everything is significance one. And more importantly, so it actually is likely to capture, so suppose you have bought all the statistics. There are, you know, 101 statistics books. Okay, you bought the first 50, and your friend bought the other. This other guy bought the next 50. So the common books between you and him, zero. And yet, based on your first 50, you know what your rating is for the 101th. Based on your first 50, you know what your rating should be for the next 50 statistics books. And based on that, you can actually, you now have more common ratings with your friend. Now, this looks like bogus, right? Because in a sense, I am interpolating users' ratings. It's as bogus as content-based filtering is bogus to begin with, right? I'm trying to learn a classifier. And if I just use it on one item at a time, you are not unhappy with me. And if I'm using it in the entire vector, why should you be unhappy with me? It's not your problem. I have computers. I'll do it in the back. Okay? So that's the basic idea. And so then I run collaborative filtering on top of this, and that improves the ratings. In fact, there is a nice paper that I have in the readings list on collaborative filtering by Mooney and his students, where they actually did a test. Again, these things are easy to come up with, harder to test, especially when there are ratings involved and there are real people rating it. So they tested it in terms of creation and recall. And they found the content-boosted collaborative filtering is better than either of them alone. Neat stuff. This should make you wonder about something else, which is, if you're a content-based filter and you're helping collaborative filtering guys, why aren't you helping yourself? You understand what I'm saying? So the content-based filter filled up all these missing blanks, right? And then that's basically using its original prediction and gave it to collaborative filtering guys. Why can't I do the following? You know that content-based filtering needs just as many training examples. A learning algorithm is likely to be better if it has more training examples. The reason originally you only use these many is because those are the only ones that were rated. So now we are playing this game where we are filling the blanks with numbers. So now the CBF also says, hey, I want to use those numbers too. Why can't I use them? Why can't I take this vector now and learn a new classifier? And then use the new classifier to come up with a new vector. And learn a new classifier on top of it. What does this remind you of? Reminds you of k-means. This is basically the idea of expectation maximization. Okay? So what you're doing is using your current training data, you learned a classifier. Using that classifier, you expect these to be the ratings for the middle ones. Now you act as if these are the real ratings. What would have been the classifier that would give you these ratings? So that would be the maximally good classifier that would give you these ratings. Now use that classifier to come up with a new vector. And keep doing this until the ratings don't change. Okay? Now, this looks like a pretty kooky idea, but you've done this sort of stuff. You've done this in k-means. Okay? So, in fact, all you need to do is, essentially, this is what I'm saying. So, learn the NBC classifier C0 using the few items for which we have user ratings. I'm saying NBC classifier because that's the classifier you know, but pretty much it will work for anything. Okay, so for few items for which you have user rating, and then let C0 predict. Now, when I say C0 for NBC, what is C0? What's the classifier for NBC? It's the set of class probabilities and the set of attribute value given class probabilities. Those are the numbers. That's what C0 is. It's a set of numbers. And you use those numbers to compute given new vector, what is its class, right? So you start with C0, and then you be eagerly predict the ratings for the rest of the unlabeled entries. Rest of the unlabeled entries. Okay? And now you do this loop from here onward. So learn a new classifier C1 using all the ratings, real and predicted. Okay? And then use C1 to re-predict the ratings of unknown items alone. Never change the known ones. You know, it makes no sense. Known ones, the user actually told you, I don't like this. And you should not be learning that, well, if I push you enough, you'll like it. You know, so you would keep the known labels as the known labels. The unknown ones, you're slowly changing the labels. This is what I'm saying. Looks like magic. Actually, it works. It works for almost the same reasons K-means works. Okay, the basic theory is expectation maximization, which I won't go into here. The only thing that you actually need to do, the one change, one small change that you need to do so that it actually does work quite well, is keep the class posterior probability prediction rather than the individual class prediction. So the idea is, remember that, so rather than say when you got in C0 and when you are predicting the unlabeled data, don't just say which is the most highly likely data, highly likely class, and say take that as a class. Instead, you say for each data item unlabeled, you'd say you belong to 0.3 C1, 0.2 C2, and 0.1 minus whatever the rest C3. So give the distribution over the classes. Is this hard? For NBC, you have the posterior distribution. You actually compute the posterior distribution over the entire set of classes, and you just take the max of it and say that's your label. I'm saying since you are doing this pseudo thing, let's keep the actual classification, actual probabilities on the classes. Now, how does that change the inside of NBC? How it changes is, now you no longer have integral examples. You might have 0.3 examples, 0.2 examples, 0.7 examples. So if you're asking what is the probability that for class C1, attribute A1 has value V1. So you're supposed to look at the list of all class C1s in the training data, and that put that in the denominator, and put in the numerator the subset of them, the number of them which have A1 equal to V1. All I'm saying now is previously it was just an integral number. But now you will also have some new items have been put 0.3 into class C1. For that, the denominator increases only by 0.3. Okay? And if in that class the A1 does have value V1, then the numerator also increases by 0.3. But you can still do, you know, decimals by decimals is still a number. Okay. This is a nice idea. Here is a picture showing that it works. Okay, I mean, I didn't try it. It is actually from a real experiment. Okay. So what these guys are doing is, so this is a learning curve. A learning curve always computes, basically plots. Any learning curve plots accuracy with respect to the training examples, the number of training examples. And every good learning algorithm hopefully will keep improving its accuracy as the number of training examples go. Given two learning algorithms, you would consider one to be better than the other if for the same number of training examples, one is able to reach higher accuracy than the second. We talked about this. You know, eventually, probably many of you will understand what I'm saying. But what matters is whether you understand it by the end of the semester, because your grade depends on that. Okay? So unfortunately, speed of learning is just as important as actually learning the material. Now, I said eventually most of you, you know, it's possible that some of you would never learn it. So even after a million years, if not you, I mean, if you're talking about a particular concept and a bunch of people, it's possible that some of them will never learn, irrespective of how many ever years they spend. And so that's also possible. A learner may never reach 100% accuracy, irrespective of how many examples they give. So suppose I'm trying to find the best line okay, that differentiates positives and negatives, and the data is being generated by a nonlinear process, I'm not ever going to do that 100%. Okay, but that's a separate issue. So this is a learning curve, and this is what you do to compare learning algorithms. And what this is showing here is this is the learning curve for an NBC-based classifier, okay, given 20, 50, 100, etc., 5,000 examples. I believe the specific case here, the specific data here is page classification. You know, you have a bunch of web pages and you're trying to classify them into, you know, different classes, com.ai, com.news. And this one is NBC plus this iteratively improving, bootstrapping yourself. And what it is given is, remember that the one thing that you need for this idea to work, where am I? Okay. For this idea to work, one thing that I need is the unlabeled examples. Rest of the items. What if you only have training examples? You have no rest of the items. Then you can't do this idea. Okay? So, this essentially is taking, I believe, 10,000 unlabeled documents on top of, you know, in this particular case, let's say this is 50 labeled documents. If you do 50 labeled documents, you get about 20% accuracy. And with the same 50 labeled documents, if you use extra 10,000 unlabeled documents and do this looping until you reach some fixed point, and then use that final classifier to predict, you're reaching 50% accuracy. Pretty darn good. Okay. There are some interesting, in fact, this idea works, and as far as this class is concerned, it's enough for me if you understand that these sorts of ideas work. Learners can bootstrap themselves. And in fact, it's like a neat connection. We were using learner content-based filtering to bootstrap a collaborative filter previously. And then I asked the question, why can't I help myself? And this is what happens. If you help yourself, this is what happens. Okay? Then I want to ask a third question, which is, why can't I help you and you help me, and then I help you and then you help me, and then I help you and you help me, until we reach some level of boredom? Okay? Okay? That is another idea. That idea is called code training. Okay? Let me first show you the example of what code training does. Consider the following example. Suppose you're trying to predict web pages as course pages. Given a web page, you're trying to say, yes, it is a course page, and no, it's not a course page. Now, these things, obviously, you know, but you know because your brain is there, but your program doesn't know. Given a web page, how does it know that it's a course home page or just CNN's page or some other page? Okay. So how do you predict this? This is a classification task. So presumably, I could do classification learning. I'm sorry, I could, did I throw it in front of you? I'm really sorry. So presumably, I could do classification learning on top of this. Okay. So here is an interesting issue. How do I represent my pages? Here is one representation of pages, bag of words on the page. Here is another representation, bag of words from all anchors pointing to that page. Bag of words from all anchors pointing to that page. Now, you could jump ahead and say, look, I'll combine both of these and the total representation of a page is x1 plus x2. But wait, in fact, you could say these are two different ways of learning to predict whether a page is a course page or not. Okay, I can just use the content of the page to predict whether the page is a course page or not. I can just use what other pages are thinking about the page to predict whether the page is a coarse page or not. Notice the nice connections between content-based filtering and collaborative filtering. Not exact, but you know what other people think of you versus what you think of yourself. That's what we are looking at. Presumably, both can be trained until you reach quite a high accuracy. However, suppose I play this game, which is suppose there are only some number of pages for which manual labels are available. Okay, a small number of pages. So in fact, let me show you this picture. Okay, this is mind-boggling. I start with 12 labeled pages. That's it. Okay, for those pages, you know whether it's a coarse page or not a coarse page. Now, here's the interesting thing. If I label them, have I labeled them with respect to both learners or only one learner? Remember, I'm talking about two learners. Learner one decides whether a page is coarse page or not based on the content of the page. Learner two decides whether a page is a coarse page or not based on what other people think about this page. Now, I gave you the real labels for this 12 pages. Is this labeling for just one of the learners or both learners? I hope you're awake, right? The reality overrides your viewpoint. Okay, the reality is this is the actual label. So both learners are supposed to approximate that function. They may be coming from different directions, but they're both trying to learn that same exact function. Okay, furthermore, so then what I'm going to do is I will train NBC1 using content of the page, using the 12 labeled pages, and use the classifiers to classify the rest of the extra 1,000 additional unlabeled pages. Having classified it, I won't use it myself. I will give this to the guy who is trying to learn based on the other information, which is the link-based information. And that guy uses that information as well as the original labels to come up with another NBC classifier, which is only based on the anchor text. And then pays you back by classifying the unlabeled examples using the anchor text. You use this. Find a new classifier, and you continue until you reach some threshold. So this is exact co-training. Each of them are training each other. Okay, and here is an example for pages, again, the homepage classification, and look at what happens. Let's see. Where are we? I think I forgot what it's supposed to be showing. Page-based, hyperlink-based. Okay, so yes. One of them is, so this is page-based classification, and this is anchor text-based classification. Okay, what's interesting is the number of iterations of co-training that you have done. A co-training iteration is I train you, you train me, one iteration. Then I train you, you train me, two iterations. Okay? You notice what is happening to the error. This time this is error, not accuracy. I hope so. No, otherwise, this would be a bad class. Okay. So what's happening is as the number of co-training iterations increase, both of them are improving. Okay. Once again, this also looks like some variation of that expectation maximization idea, where you're bootstrapping, you know, instead of me pulling myself my own boots, I'll pull you up with your bootstraps and you pull me up with my bootstraps and both of us will raise hopefully quite high. Okay. Now, for this, thankfully, I can give you some theoretical reasoning as to why this might work. Okay. Here's the interesting idea. And in fact, when you're looking at this, you can actually look at that example in the back of your head. Okay. So suppose each instance has two parts, x1 and x2. Now for our problem, what were the two parts? x1 would be based on the content of the page, x2 would be based on the anchor text of the page. These are two different pieces. So each feature vector is really based on x1 and x2 together. Okay? Now suppose each half x1 as well as x2 can be used to classify an instance. So you can learn just based on x1 or learn based on x2. That was the case for us too. We could learn just based on the content or based on the anchor text. Furthermore, this is the big deal. Where is the big deal? Okay, this is the big deal, which is, suppose x1 and x2 are conditionally independent given the label. Given the label, can you, so this is something that you can actually test, but also if this is the case, so would you assume that once I know that this page is a course page, can I reasonably say that the content of the page is conditionally independent of the anchor text, given that I know that this is a page? Now, this is sort of like saying runny nose and itchy eyes. Okay, both are caused by flu. Okay, if I don't know that you are suffering from flu, and if you just come and say nose is running, and you just said it from outside, and I can assume something about itchiness of your eyes, because many people who have runny noses also have itchy eyes. But if you already told me you have flu, then telling me that you have runny nose doesn't give me any more information about itchy eyes, because the same flu caused both of them. This is the classic point we've used in Bayes network. If the same thing is causing these two, then given this guy, this is independent of this. So my question is, to the extent class is causing both anchor text and the content, would I be reasonable in assuming that they are independent? Now, again, you have to understand that it's not always going to be the case that they're independent. So for example, if I took X1 to be the first half of the page and X2 to be the second half of the page, they may not be independent. But to the extent they are independent, then what happens is the errors that the one learner makes wind up being just noise for the other learner. Okay, and vice versa. Okay, and this winds up helping them bootstrap each other. So in theory, you can actually show that if they are conditionally independent, you can show from a theoretical point of view that these iterations must increase the overall accuracy of both the learners. And in practice, many a time, they are not conditionally independent. They're sort of independent, but not fully independent. And yet it seems to work quite well. Okay, yet another little trick up your sleeve. You just have one learner, naive Bayes classifier, but we're going to milk it, as long as we can to get as much juice out of it as possible. Okay, so those are two neat ideas that I just thought of are connected to collaborative filtering. Let me just end by saying that supposedly talked about recommendation systems. We talked about the two different kinds of recommendation systems, content-based and collaborative. We talked about how to combine them. And in trying to combine them, we also kind of talked about some fun things of how you can combine classification learning algorithms with each other or by themselves to improve their overall accuracy. Now, these algorithms work. Both the EM as well as co-training work. Showing you theoretically that they work would be out of the scope of this class. I would be happy to give you links, of papers that will do the theoretical argument. That's why they work. But it's the same sort of, at some level, they are, that the first one is sort of like k-means. Okay? And basically, both of them are EM, expectation maximization algorithm. And the second one is basically working because of this independence. The two learners are, in essence, independent. And so the classification errors of one learner is going to be noise to the other learner. There's no pattern. I'll end here. I don't exactly know what I'll do next class, but I will send you an email. Okay?